Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer dude and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl, and I am still just a dude.
I keep adding things to mine.
I don't have anything else to add. The only thing I'll add to mine is in the grave.
In the grave. I don't think you'll be the one adding that. That'll probably be me.
Well, that's probably
Tommy's
true.
Tommy's not here today. He's, he's in the grave.
So you'll be making the duty jokes by yourself. It's your duty.
I'm Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer, dude, judge, and a pallbearer.
And it's my duty to inform you there'll be no more duty jokes.
Oh, my.
Well, we're going to jump into a topic that you brought up last week as might be of interest.
Yeah, last episode we were talking about different things. We mentioned Sir William Blackstone.
Yeah.
And he is a famous English jurist that we talked about him a little bit. We didn't really say much about him other than that. And we talked about him before. And I think he's a person of note that warrants having his own episode.
Sure. He did a lot of things towards the law. And not only that, it might have been over in England, but it actually shaped the course of the United States and the Declaration of Independence and all the amendments and everything else. Our forefathers were influenced by his writings.
Oh, heavily. So he, as I said, he was a famous English jurist. He was born in 1723 in London and passed away in 1780. So he was
57. He was a young man.
Yeah, 57. He was most famous for writing the commentaries on the laws of England. And it's essentially the best known description of the doctrines of English law back then. And the book is essentially the basis of legal education in England and North America. So that's where a lot of our legal education comes from. And he was also knighted in 1770, so he was a knight.
Like Elton John.
I don't think he had a suit of armor, though. I think by 1770, they had stopped doing that.
Yeah, they didn't give him suits of any armor anymore.
He was the fourth son of Charles.
He couldn't have worn it anyway. He was a very portly fellow.
He heavily influenced the law.
Yeah.
He was the fourth son of Charles Blackstone, who was a silk merchant. Unfortunately, his father died before he was born, and his mother passed away when he was 12. So he was kind of on his own from a early beginning there.
Yeah, his father passed away before he was born. His father was alive for the first 5 months of his while he was being born.
Correct.
But it died 4 months before he was born. I just wanted to clear that up so if there's any misconceptions as to who he belonged to.
He went to live with his uncle, a surgeon in London named Thomas Big. And he...
Mr. Big, they
Mr.
called
Big.
Him.
Dr. Big.
Dr. Big.
He didn't go to medieval law school for... Medieval medical school for all those years not to be called doctor.
Dr. Big.
And so while he lived with his uncle, he was able to study the classics, which sounds like kind of a pretty cool backstory for any character. He also studied logic and math.
Well, those are all good things to study, although I'm not sure what kind of job you get with that background. Read the classics and logic and math.
It just sounds kind of cool, like, you know, if you're writing a backstory for a character. I studied the classics. I matriculated at Oxford.
Well, that's the thing that got me. He got in on a hardship scholarship to Oxford, and it sounds like he was there as a career student for a while.
Pretty much.
Just kind of taking in whatever he wanted to take in. He wasn't even studying law. And here he was, a noted, you know, for his legal knowledge, and he wasn't even studying law yet.
Well, that comes into play, though, his studying logic and math, I think, later on.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's kind of how his approach to the law, he used a very logical approach to it.
Well, and I guess this reading the classics is where it brought about his humanity.
That's true.
Although they said that he was described as loved humanity, but he didn't like people.
Yeah, I don't. He didn't seem like, from what I read about him, like he was a very sociable type person.
He was not. He didn't have much to do with anybody, but yet in his writings of how law should be applied, it was always with compassion towards people.
That's true. Interesting note, when I said matriculate, matriculate does not actually mean to graduate. Did you know that matriculate only means to basically enter?
Yeah, well, that's what I saw, that it matriculated to the next thing, and I thought, well, that's a strange way of putting it.
Yeah. So if someone graduates,
matriculate on down the road, y'all.
If someone graduates, that means they actually graduated with a degree. But if they matriculate, that just basically means they enrolled.
They just enrolled and kind of studied around.
Yeah. So as you said, his writing style was very elegant, and that's probably why his works became so popular, because he was able to write very clearly, concisely, and with a bit of panache.
Panache?
Panache.
Pizzazz?
Pizzazz.
Ganache. Now I'm hungry. Chocolate ganache.
In 1741, he became a student at the Middle Temple, which is one of the Inns of Courts. The Inns of Court in London are professional associations for barristers in England and Wales. And there's four different Inns of Courts, and all barristers have to belong to one of them. There's Gray's Inn, Lincoln's Inn, Inner Temple, and Middle Temple.
Are those like taverns?
No, they're just different, I guess, almost.
Gray's Inn. Let's go have a Guinness at Gray's Inn.
Like clubhouses almost, I guess, yeah, would be the way I would describe it.
And every lawyer in London has one of those. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they have to belong to one. Every barrister has to belong to one of them.
Wow.
We have something similar in a, not similar, we have something in America called the Inns of Court too, but it's not, it's kind of like a voluntary type association. Hmm. So,
well, you better know the ins and outs or you're going to end up on the outs.
In 1743, he was elected a member of All Souls College, Oxford. A year later, he became a fellow. And by 1746, he had become a barrister.
He's a jolly good fellow.
He was a jolly good fellow. And his practice was not very successful. It was not really what his career path was going to be. In college, he was very active and able to make a lot of improvements and things like that. But really, in his private practice, he didn't really do much as a private attorney, private barrister.
No, it took him a while before he was even admitted to the bar, wasn't it? Before he was called up to the bar, as they called it?
Well, yeah, that's true, because it was 1746 until he became a barrister.
Yeah. Well, they said that it kind of amounted to he didn't make many friends. And you kind of had to have somebody on the inside that helped move you up. You had to have connections. And he wasn't much on working on connections. So it took a while before he finally, I guess, got somebody to sponsor him or whatever. You know, it's like an exclusive club. You got to have so many members inside vote on you to bring you in before you can get in.
That's true. And that's kind of similar to how the Inns of Court in the United States work as well, because they're like local little like clubs and things like that.
Yeah.
So, but you could definitely say that Blackstone was a bit of an academic, kind of a book guy.
Not a people guy.
Not a people guy. In 1750, Blackstone took the degree of Doctor of Civil Law. In July of 1753, he decided to retire from his practice at the ripe old age of 30. So he didn't practice law very long.
He wasn't interested in practicing law, because practice law, you had to deal with people.
That's right.
And he didn't like to deal with people.
And once he retired, he decided to concentrate on teaching academic law and doing legal work in and around Oxford.
And thinking about law. And writing about law. I think he, in a way, what he did is he felt that the laws were inaccessible to the common man. Because how many people had the books and all the things with all the laws in it and could follow it and things like that? So he tried to break it down into interpretations that would make it easier for the common man to understand. And somewhere they could go and look in this book to try to find something that concerned what was going on. Kind of like our podcast.
we're the Blackstone of the modern era.
Yeah, we're the Blackstone. I'm the old fat bloated guy.
You're the innkeeper.
That's right.
Drinking the mead.
Yeah.
He also was a assessor, which was also the judge of the Chancellor's Court since 1751. So he kept that title as well as the chancery judge, basically.
Well, and he even pushed for a while. He got moved up to the King's Court, which I think was kind of like a Supreme Court type thing.
That was a little bit later on.
Yeah, he that was one of the things he wanted to aspire to, but then after he got there, he only lasted about a year.
So I mentioned he was the a judge of the Chancery Court, and there's a difference between Chancery Court and a court at law. Do you know what the difference is?
Other than the spelling, no.
Chancery, those courts are able to afford equitable relief, like injunctions, making people do or not do things, stuff kind of like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas courts at law are ones that can actually award monetary damages. So it was split at that time that there's two different kinds of courts. So if you needed a certain kind of remedy that was not really about money, you would go to a chancery court. If you needed money, you'd go to a court of law.
What about criminal? Was that criminal court?
Criminal law would have been probably under the court of law, I would assume, because it was codified.
Oh, okay.
Chancery courts were based on equity, what was fair, and that was kind of their guiding principle. So,
well, shouldn't all courts do what are fair?
Well,
what is fair?
No, they should follow the law.
Even if it's not fair?
They should follow the law.
Oh, okay.
So,
there's a basic fallacy.
Maybe. The law should change then.
Life isn't fair. Why should the law be? Learn that lesson at a young age, son.
In the United States, we actually used to have that difference as well between chancery courts and courts of law, but now in the common day, those have kind of merged into one. So you don't have those different kinds of courts based upon the relief you want. It's all contained in one court.
Did we call them that?
We used to, yeah.
Okay.
Not anymore, though. Now, Blackstone went on to kind of bigger and better things and to help the common man. And we want to get more into that because that's really what Blackstone's all about. But before that, I think there might be a couple of motions before the court today.
Well, there is one motion there, your judgeship, for real, sir. We'd like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right. Who's on the docket?
We have on the docket our good friends at Care Of.
Care Of is a wellness brand that makes it easy to maintain your health goals with a customized vitamin plan that helps you feel your best today and supports you long term.
Now, you can set a resolution you'll actually keep. Make 2020 the year you prioritize you and commit to staying on top of your health.
One of the cool things about Care Of is you can take a short online quiz and answer some questions about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle. And Care Of will recommend a list of vitamins and supplements specifically for your health needs and goals.
The vitamin aisle can be confusing. It's hard to know what you need and where to start.
Answer easy questions like, how much sleep do you get? How often do you go work out? Do you follow any specialty diets? Are you concerned about your hair, skin, and nail health? And more!
Follow Care Of's expert recommendations or adjust your pack at any time. What you receive is totally up to you.
Now, I've gone to the website, and I've been able to take the online quiz and talk about the different things in my lifestyle. And based upon that, there were recommendations from Care Of about the vitamins that should be shipped to me. It was simple as pie.
Well, and I did the same thing. I went through my quiz and took it. And the main goal that I was achieving is I said, I'm tired all the time. Is there anything that I can take that can help me have more energy to get through my day so I'm not drinking coffee and energy drinks? Because that's not healthy. And they compiled a packet of vitamins for me, and I started taking them and felt the change within a day or two.
And that's the cool thing is that when you get these packets, they come individually wrapped for each day, and it's personalized just for you about what you're supposed to take.
Yeah, no two are the same, unless you have the exact same things as somebody else, you know. But other than that, it's vitamins like snowflakes.
Right now, court-appointed listeners get a special deal. You want to tell them what it is, Tommy?
Well, heck yeah. You get 50% off your first Care Of order. Just go to takecareof.com and enter code COURT50.
So for 50% off your first Care Of order, go to takecareof.com and enter the code COURT50.
That's right. Get your healthy dose of vitamins, courtesy of Care Of.
So while studying the law and during his educational experiences, Blackstone developed an interest in common law. And when we talk about common law, we've talked about this before on our previous episodes, but common law is what is derived from custom practice in prior cases. It's not necessarily something that's codified like our laws today that we have in our books.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, common law was even more confusing than it is today. What Blackstone was able to do, he was able to take the difficulties and contradictions of all the different court cases and traditions and things that were handed down, and he was able to give a subject of an air of completeness that made it a uniform, logical system. So like we had said previously, if you remember, he had studied math and logic. So I think that he brought that to the legal field. He was able to use his analytical mind and apply that to the law and help teach that and make common law for other people.
Well, I think that a lot of times, especially in those days, some of the lawyers held themselves aloof, and they really, that knowledge that they had is what they held to wield power over others. So I don't think that a lot of them really appreciated him making the law more accessible to the common man.
He's bringing law to the masses.
Yeah.
He was quoted as saying in a lecture on June 23rd, 1753, "It is proposed to lay down a general and comprehensive plan of the laws of England, to deduce their history, to enforce and illustrate their leading rules and fundamental principles, and to compare them with the laws of nature and of other nations."
Yeah,
it's pretty cool that there was actually, you can pinpoint the date and the year that he actually said that, and it was that long ago.
Well, he was quite verbose in how he wrote. Nothing was succinct and to the point. Most of his things that he says, you really have to read them two or three times to understand what he's saying. And that day, that was just the way they talked, so I'm sure it was nothing to them. But to the modern-day language, it was very verbose.
In 1759, he left his job as a judge in the Chancery Court and became a bencher. Which is a lecturer and supervisor of the Middle Temple Inns of Court. So he ascended to kind of a supervisory role and a teaching role at the Inns of Court.
Instead of the front lines.
That's right. He's like, nah, go ahead. Well, this job looks better.
That's what they say. Those that can't do, teach.
And 1761 was a big year for Blackstone. In March of 1761, he was elected to Parliament.
Well, there you go.
In May of 1761, he married Sarah Clitheroe, and in July of 1761, he was appointed as the principal of New Inn Hall, which is like Oxford's law school back then, kind of like what it was back then. That was kind of a big year for him.
It's a very big year.
In 1763, he became the Solicitor General to the Queen, and he eventually left academics in 1766 after his proposal to turn New Inn Hall into a specialized common law college was rejected. So what he wanted to do was he wanted to take the common law and teach that and make that a very accessible place for everybody to learn that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, nah, I don't think so.
That's not a good idea.
Yeah. And so he said, you know what? I'm out. And he quit.
You know, even though that they said he didn't like people much, I thought it was interesting to note you mentioned when he was married in 1761, he ended up having 9 kids.
Yeah.
So he must have liked his wife anyway.
Probably so. The numbers would bear to support that theory. He was in the House of Commons for 9 years, and he described himself as a moderate. And so he wasn't very prolific in the House of Commons either. He didn't really have much fire or passion. He just was kind of like, I'm a moderate.
He was also a Tory, but the Tories didn't really like him. He didn't do all the Tory stuff they thought he should do.
Yeah, which is probably why history wasn't too keen on him for his time in the Parliament.
Yeah.
Now, in 1770, he was appointed as the judge of the Court of Common Pleas, where he served for 10 years until his health failed, and he finally passed away in 1780.
Like I say, he was only 57.
Yes.
Still a young man.
Do you know what one of his most famous quotes was?
Well, it is better that 10 guilty escape than 1 innocent suffer.
That is one, but here's my favorite. He is noted as saying on the bench during a hearing, "I say, old chap, that I fear your hound shall never find its quarry."
That's kind of like, this dog don't hunt. No wonder you like that one.
He actually didn't say that. I just wanted to translate my famous phrase into something Blackstone said.
You plagiarizing him. Now, he was known for several of them. One was the one that I said, it is better that 10 guilty escape than 1 innocent suffer. He also said, free men have arms, slaves do not.
Yeah.
And he said that the king can do no wrong is a necessary and fundamental principle of the English Constitution.
Yeah. Well, it might be for that, but I kind of disagree with that principle.
Well, in that government, I mean, we're not talking about the same as America.
No.
In that, they're saying that what he said is, the king isn't wrong, the law may be wrong, but the king isn't wrong.
Right. I would venture to guess that in England, they don't tend to think that the king is an infallible person, or the queen is an infallible
person. Not now, but in those days, I bet they did.
Oh, in those days, yeah.
You didn't certainly speak ill of the king.
No.
Or you might not have a tongue to speak ill of the king the next time.
Or head. Off with their head.
That's right. Just ask those Henry VIII wives.
So as we said, he's most famous not for my made-up dog won't hunt quote.
I can't believe you did that.
And it slipped right past you.
I just assumed that's where it was derived from that maybe that was a real thing. And it was just the Appalachian version was that dog just don't hunt.
He's most famous for the commentaries on the laws of England, which was originally published by the Clarendon Press at Oxford in 1765 through 1770. The work is divided into four volumes on the rights of persons, the rights of things, of private wrongs, of public wrongs. So when you think about the rights of persons, you're thinking about kind of constitutional type rights or things that are important to people. The rights of things, which is property law. Private wrongs, which would be tort law, like when you sue somebody for a car accident or something like that, although they didn't have cars back then. Or public wrongs, which would be criminal law.
His horse ran into my horse. He ran right into his ass. Oh, don't say that. Wrecked him. Wrecked him. Hell, he killed him.
No, he hit a horse or he hit a donkey. Make up your mind. The Commentaries was the leading work on the development of English law and played a major role in the development of the American legal system, as you alluded to earlier.
Yeah, a lot of his writings is what our forefathers used to shape our laws. One of the things that I read that he commented on that made it into ours had to do with impeachment.
Really?
And it had to do with the laws of impeachment.
That's topical.
Yeah. I fell right into it. I was looking at it, reading what he had to say about it, and it was that he, besides treason and high crimes and misdemeanor, but that he had in his, you know, we say there's no real definition of high crimes and misdemeanor. We discussed that
exactly,
before.
Exactly, yep.
Two things that he put forth that he felt constituted high crimes and misdemeanors that fell under that were bribery and perjury.
I can see that.
That he felt both of those constituted high crimes and misdemeanor. And the phrase that they used for perjury was when a man has the audacity to offend God because he's too cowardly to speak the truth to man. And I thought, well, that's a pretty high and mighty way of looking at perjury.
That is. Well, if you think about it, perjury and bribery, though, those are two pretty, obviously deceptive type practices. So there's something that you would not really want your leader to partake in.
Exactly.
So I can definitely see that.
So while that's not written specifically into the law, there have been ones that have looked to his interpretations when they're looking for what constitutes impeachment.
Well, now his works and his writings have been incorporated into a lot of different opinions by courts.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-revolutionary source of common law by the U.S. courts relied heavily upon his work. Opinions of the Supreme Court of the U.S. often quote Blackstone's work whenever they wish to engage in a historical discussion that goes back far, or whenever they're talking about the intent of the framers of the Constitution, because he was a contemporary of them of that time. So they look to Blackstone to kind of interpret what the Constitution means during those times as well. So here's an interesting tidbit about commentaries on the laws of England that I did not know. The book was famously used as the key in Benedict Arnold's book cipher, which he used to communicate secretly with his conspirator, John Andre, during their plot to betray the Continental Army during the American Revolution.
Well, you know,
so that was the cipher.
Huh.
So it was a very ubiquitous book.
Well, I also think that one of the things is from that one quote that I said earlier of his, it is better that 10 guilty escape than one innocent suffer. I think that the way we set up our system, that it's an adversarial system and that the rights of the accused have to be maintained in a certain way, no matter what the evidence, you know, not evidence, but what everybody feels happened,
right,
that you have to prove it. And it puts the burden more on the person proving the case against the person than the defendant.
Right.
And I think that plays along with that way of thinking.
So not what's fair, but just to follow the law.
Right.
Aha, mm-hmm. You're coming around.
Well, I'm not saying that's right, but I'm saying that's the way I think our laws are written. that they followed that way of thinking.
So The Rights of Persons is the first volume in the four-part series. It's divided into 18 chapters and is largely concerned with the rights of individuals, the rights of Parliament, the rights and title of the king, the royal family, the councils belonging to the king, kingly duties, the royal prerogative, the king's revenue, subordinate magistrates, the people, the rights of the clergy, the civil state, the military and maritime states, the relationship between the master and servant, which we talked about last episode during the employment law, because master and servant essentially means employment law, husband and wife, parent and child, guardian and ward, and corporations.
And Batman and Robin.
Batman and Robin was not in there.
Ugh.
Talking about Burt Ward?
Yeah.
The second book is The Rights of Things, which is actually the longest volume and deals with property. The vast majority of the text is devoted to real property. This was the most valuable sort in the feudal law upon which the English law was founded.
Mm-hmm.
Property and chattels was also beginning to overshadow property and land, but its law lacked the complex feudal background of the common law of the land and was not dealt with nearly as extensively by Blackstone. So rather than talking about personal property, it didn't talk about that much. It was devoted pretty much to real property, like land and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The of private wrongs dealt with torts as they existed in Blackstone's time, like when a horse hits a horse.
Cut out the horseplay.
The various methods of trial that existed at civil law were also dealt in this volume, as were the jurisdictions of the several courts from the lowest to the highest. So they incorporated the procedural aspects, like the civil procedure was kind of contained in this too, like how a trial shall flow. And Blackstone also adds a brief chapter on equity, the parallel system that existed in English law at that time, like we talked about, how you seek to address wrongs that the common law did not handle, which he was a judge under an equitable court. So he threw that in there to talk about how equity plays a role in the overall scheme of law. So he was already starting to kind of merge chancery and courts of law at that point there. So the of public wrongs is his treatise on criminal law, and Blackstone takes, and here Blackstone takes kind of the high road and talks about how the criminal laws of England were very just and merciful, despite the fact that it was known as the Bloody Code for their severity during that time.
Well, he didn't want to offend the king.
Probably not.
He kept the king in high regard.
He does say, and he's quoted as saying, "It is a melancholy truth that among the variety of actions which men are daily liable to commit, no less than 160 have been declared by act of parliament to be felonious without benefit of clergy, or in other words, to be worthy of instant death."
160 acts, huh?
Yeah, so definitely the Bloody Code.
Yeah.
Blackstone often resorted to assuring the readers that the laws as written were not always enforced, and the king's power of pardon could be exercised to correct any hardships or injustices. There again, falling back to his equitable roots, talking about, well, that's the law, but, you know, the king can override that in their infinite wisdom. They can don't necessarily have to follow that.
If they want to waste their time thinking about it.
Yeah. So those were his different books, and that was the foundation of pretty much law in the United States.
Yeah, because it's one thing to just go through and just read a law written on a page. It's another to have someone group them into some type of order that you could read through, and instead of saying, what does this mean? It tells you this guy's interpretation. What does it mean? Now, not everybody agreed with everything he said.
Right.
But it certainly seemed to be generally accepted by the masses.
And if you look at the way these different four books are broken down, they almost mirror what you take in your first and second year of law school. So if you're looking at the rights of persons, well, there you're talking about
court law.
Well, no, rights of person, you're talking about constitutional law.
Oh.
So these are the rights that are guaranteed to people. And you talk about the different ways the government works and things like that. So con law would be almost like that. And that is something you learn early on in law school. The rights of things, property. So you have property law in class. That's one of the very first classes you take. Private wrongs. So you have torts. That's another class you take early on in law school.
Mm-hmm.
Public wrongs. That's the class you take for criminal law.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you have civil procedure, which is also contained in the private wrongs. So it shows how different court cases go along and things like that. So really, if you look at the way he broke down his different areas of law in the commentaries, that's essentially the blueprint for how the American legal education takes place. I mean, it's not broken down into four things. I mean, they've broken it out a bit more.
Right.
Each of those are contained in there.
I thought it was interesting. He had, somewhere along the line, he must have known that he was onto something.
I think I'm onto something here.
Because he had a personal biographer. And for a guy that, you know, kind of the way he's portrayed in history, to have a personal biographer, it just seemed a little strange. But it said that October 25th, 1758, William Blackstone approached the podium in the Oxford Lecture Hall, and he knew he was a failure. He considered himself a failure in what he had done because he was not a good lawyer. He was good at interpreting the law, but he wasn't good at presenting the law, like in cases and stuff. The 30-year-old lawyer, nearsighted, already portly, chronically ill, now ready to read his notes in his grating voice, had spent the last 7 years before the bar in London when a sympathetic biographer wrote that he had little notice or practice. Now, this is what the biographer said. Now, addressing the students assembled before him to hear the first of his lectures on English law, Blackstone began with an apology. Speaking in the third person, Blackstone worried aloud that if his plan was crude or injudicious or the execution of it lame or superficial, he would set back the study of law. And this he must more especially dread when he feels by experience how unequal his abilities are to complete in the manner he could wish so extensive and arduous a task, since he freely confesses that his former, more private attempts have fallen very short of his own ideas of perfection.
Yes, he felt I couldn't really accomplish what I wanted to do.
But he really was passionate about it, though, of presenting the law that way, because that was his fears, that I'm not going to be able to do what I think needs to be done, and it needs to be perfect. It's not just that it needs to be good, it needs to be perfect. I mean, he really felt passionate about it. He just didn't have confidence in himself that he was the guy to do it, even though he set out to do it. And little could Blackstone have known that the lectures he began so tentatively that day would be published as Commentaries on the Laws of England, a work that would dominate the common law system for more than a century, nor could he foresee that his words would shape the Declaration of Independence, Constitution, and primal laws of a land he considered no more than conquered territory of the British Crown. He could not foresee another failure in life studying his commentaries in the frontier village of New Salem, Illinois, teaching himself law. And he could not imagine that 200 years later, gangsters would call their lawyers by his name. Yeah, what are you, Blackstone?
That was a term back then?
That was a term in the 20s that gangsters would call their lawyers Blackstone.
Really?
Yeah, and it was from him. And you know who they were talking about, the failure in Springfield, Illinois, that studied his manuscripts?
Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. He was a big study of that and the laws, and that's where he learned the law from, was his commentaries.
Yeah, he has a very strong basis in our American legal system. He probably never even envisioned or could imagine that in the year 2020 that there would be a podcast talking about him.
No, I doubt that he thought about a podcast. If he did, then he was really a man ahead of his time. One of the things that he said, though, that he proved that his best and worst critic when he wrote is, it is well if the mass of mankind will obey laws when made, without scrutinizing too nicely into the reasons of making them. So he was kind of saying, you know, just go ahead and follow them. Don't question them too much because, you know, that causes problems. So if the law was made, somebody had a reason, and we'll tell you what the reason is, but don't think about them too much.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
We got this under control.
They don't need to be scrutinized. Just follow them. It's kind of like my dad used to tell me. Don't do as I do as I say.
Those are classic dad words.
Yeah. I mean, he said a democracy's fine, but it don't work here.
Oh, you thought this was a democracy? No, you were wrong.
Well, also, I brought a little bonus thing. We mentioned last week that you said, have you heard of Blackstone? And I said, yeah, but are we talking about the magician?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know. I mean, that just came into the foggy recesses of my brain. I didn't know if that was real or not. Well, there was a Blackstone, the magician.
Really?
Harry Booton Blackstone. He was actually Harry Booton, but he added the name Blackstone.
He must have been a lawyer, too.
He was born in... No, he was an illusionist. He was born
like I said, he must have been a lawyer, too.
He was born in 1885 and died in 1965. And he was a famed stage magician, not musician.
Although he did a little singing and dancing on the side.
He probably did while he was doing it. But he became very famous in his time and traveled amongst all the people in Hollywood and things like that. And he would have an orchestra that would perform while he was doing his magic tricks. And he, like, developed the one sawing a woman in half. And he had one that involved, you know, where they do the levitation, where they have the girl float and they do the hoop back and forth over, yeah, showing there's nothing on her and things like that.
No strings.
Yeah, he developed all those kind of things. And the floating light bulb, where the light bulb that he used was actually designed by Thomas Edison.
Really?
Yeah, and it was called, the effect was called the Enchanted Garden, in which countless bouquets of brilliant feathered flowers appear from under a foulard, and on tables and stands until the stage was a riot of color. And then the floating light bulb was perhaps a signature piece. In a darkened theater, Blackstone would take a lighted bulb from a lamp and float it, still glowing, through a small hoop. He would then come down from the stage, and the lamp would float out over the heads of the audience. Dutch illusionist Hans Cloke became the custodian of Blackstone's famous floating light bulb illusion after the death of Blackstone.
Do we know how he did it?
No, he never revealed how he did any of those
things. Well, a magician never reveals their tricks.
But
unless you're on Fox.
But the one, you may remember, you talked about having a kit?
Yeah.
The kit was actually from his son, who was also a magician, Blackstone Jr.
Really?
He was born in 1934 and died in 1997. And he is estimated to have pulled 80,000 rabbits from his sleeves and hat.
I'm going to question how he came up with that number.
But he was also a stage magician, and he went in conjunction with P.F. Flyers. Remember the old tennis shoes, P.F. Flyers? And came out with the P.F. Magic Wedge Kit and had that. And he was also on commercials for Jiffy Pop Popcorn.
Oh, wow.
And but he worked in magic until the day he died, and he donated his father's original floating light bulb to the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., where it's on display. And he also donated the dancing handkerchief illusion. That was the first donation that he gave to him. So, and he appeared on many shows: The Tonight Show, Donahue, The Today Show, Reading Rainbow, Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
Wow, all the classics.
He starred as Dr. Mephisto on the TV soap opera Santa Barbara. And he was on a special with the Muppets. And he designed illusions used on SeaWorld's Water Show featuring the DC Comics superheroes. They included the Joker cutting Batgirl up into multiple pieces, a variation of the classic multi-box illusion, and the first use in many years of the Jarrett pedestal to vanish Wonder Woman. So he took magic to the entertainment levels as far as movie and shows and things like that.
And he sold a kit to me.
Yeah, that's right. But there were two Blackstones, Harry Blackstone Sr. and Harry Blackstone Jr.
Now, was there a Harry Blackstone III who carried on the business?
No, it died with him. I think there was too many rabbits there. 80,000. The rabbit died.
He was hopping around too much to have a family.
That's right.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we talk about different legal terms. I'm going to ask Tommy if he knows some of the things we talked about today.
I know nothing.
What are the ends of court?
The ends of court are the four things established there in Britain, where you have to belong to one of the four of them to be a lawyer.
Be a barrister.
To be a barrister, not a lawyer, huh?
Yeah, they have different.
Be a barrister.
They have different names over there. And barristers are the ones who appear in court.
What does a lawyer do? Or are they one and the same?
In England, they have barristers and they have solicitors. So the barristers are the ones that defend people in court, and the solicitors are people that perform work outside the court. So,
well, that's kind of what the solicitors here do. Perform work outside the court, but then they might end up in the court.
That is true. Now, the different ends of court in England are Gray's Inn, Lincoln's Inn, the Inner Temple, and the Middle Temple. Those are the four different ones. And we have different inns of court here in the United States, but they're kind of different. So it's not the same thing.
Not the Star Chamber, huh? That's not one of them?
That is not one of them, thankfully. What is the difference between a chancery court and a court of law?
One has to do with equitability. The chancery court has to do with equitability and things being equitable.
Equitability?
Yeah.
Is that a word?
I think so. Things being equitable. So there, like, someone has to pay something that they owe and some things like that. So they make you whole that way. And then the other one, the court of law, has to do with being fined or criminal court cases or something like that.
Kind of mixed them up a little bit there.
Oh, okay.
So you're on the right track. A chancery court is an equitable court where the court tries to make things fair. Like if somebody needs an injunction against somebody to make them stop doing something, or there's some way that they need to fashion some sort of relief that really can't be, you really can't put a price tag on or a number. Whereas a court of law is pretty much about numbers. So if there's a breach of contract and we can say that definitively you owe me $50,000 or 50,000 pounds or something like that, then the court of law can award that to me. Whereas if we go to a chancery court and we have a contract and you're going to breach the contract and sell something you promised to sell to me to someone else, I could say to chancery court, hey, I want you to stop him from selling that to that person. He promised to sell it to me. And the chancery court could say, no, Tommy, you can't sell that to that person. You have to sell it to Mike. So that would be kind of the difference between a chancery court and a court of law.
Okay.
So
I'll try to remember that, your judgeship.
Well, it doesn't matter anymore because now those courts have kind of merged. So it's kind of a little bit of a historical footnote.
So it's like learning Latin.
But still useful to understand the basis of it. What are the four different books contained in the Commentaries on Laws of England?
Oh, heck. Well, one has to do with property law.
Right.
One has to do with private law. in other words, why don't you just tell us, Mike? We could be here all night. And one's procedural, I know that.
They are the rights of persons, the rights of things, of private wrongs, of public wrongs. So the rights of persons has to do with kind of constitutional type law or people's rights. The rights of things has to do with property law. Private wrongs has to do with procedure, like you said, and also with tort law. And public wrongs has to do with criminal law.
Okay. So. Yeah, property was very important in those days because that's how they measured wealth mostly. Yeah. By your property. I mean, because you wanted to have, you know, people working on your property that work for you. It was kind of like a whole one of those systems where the pyramid scheme, kind of like
master and servant.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to have people working your land because you owed stuff to somebody else. So it all, you know, the crap's rolling downhill and you don't want to be in the valley.
I was going to say it's going uphill, but downhill works too. It's not good to be in the valley, though, if it's rolling downhill.
You're passing the money up, and the crap's coming down.
That's right.
If you're in the valley, you're going to get overflowed.
It's the ebb and the flow.
That's right.
Well, that's going to do it for Legal Briefs. Not too bad. I figured you would know the last one, though, because that seemed like an obvious Legal Brief-type question.
What, those four things?
Yeah.
Well, I just couldn't remember the names. I kind of remembered that they broke down into the different areas.
I remember there were different areas.
There were different areas.
I didn't remember what they were about.
I didn't know what they were called.
But I knew there were different areas.
I'm not even sure where I'm at. Order in the court. Oh, that's your line.
I've never said that. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought is boneless wings. I feel like boneless wings are fake news. In this day and age of just make up whatever truth you want someone to believe and then say it enough that eventually people start to believe even the most outrageous of things, I am not buying into boneless wings. This is where I draw the line. I know there are much more important things out there, and some of these other grand misdirections should mean much more and evoke a greater emotional response. But I have become numb to a lot of these other obvious untruths. But not wings. Never wings. I take my wings very seriously, and I resent even having to answer the question, traditional or boneless. For one thing, traditional is a misnomer. They are not traditional wings. They are wings the way that God and other chickens made them. It is an actual cut of meat from a discernible part of the chicken, not a tradition. There is no guesswork that goes into it. Sure, some are actually legs while others are wings, but they are real and you can tell where they came from. That is a batch of chicken wings. Although I do have to admit, I was once confused by buffalo wings. I thought buffaloes don't have wings. Is this some kind of cut of beef they are cutting like wings and passing them off? Then I realized, oh, it's a sauce they're referring to on actual chicken wings. Boy, did I feel like a big dummy. But let's set the record straight. There is no such thing as boneless chicken wings. This name is an ill-conceived attempt to just upcharge you for chicken nuggets. I mean, let's be honest. Boneless chicken wings are chicken nuggets. It is an indiscernible piece of chicken meat, a sauced-up glob of chicken that may or may not even be natural. You've seen nuggets up close. Would you swear everything in there is chicken? I wouldn't. So let's end this foul lie. Get it? Foul lie, F-O-W-L. Sorry, I couldn't pass that up, but I digress. Let's end this foul lie and do away with the terminology boneless wings. You can sell wings or you can sell sauced up nuggets, but do not pee down my back and tell me it's raining, and do not try to sell me boneless wings because they do not exist. They are nuggets. Totally different. This has been Tommy's Random Thoughts.